Okay, yeah, it's good. Thanks. Okay, now we're going to go to happiness interventions. And let me start with talking about optimism. It's just important to keep in mind that optimism is important in a lot of ways, but some of you have heard me talk about this. We did a study not too long ago where we looked at dozens of predictors of religious actions and beliefs in a group of modern Orthodox yeshiva high school seniors. And we threw many, many variables into the computer. Their self-concept, their psychological functioning, their family relationships. And what came up as the single most important correlate of religious action and beliefs was a connection to a positive connection, an optimistic connection to God as shown by family and shown by school. When the focus was on the positive, when the focus was on the love dimension, that's when kids were most likely to internalize religious values, religious actions, and religious beliefs. I was reminded, I was giving a talk on happiness. I was scholar in residence somewhere, and my host told me that his mother was an adolescent in the concentration camps, I think in Auschwitz. And he believed, when I was talking about optimism, he told me, that one of the reasons she survived and has done so well, she's still alive today, was because she was inherently an incredibly optimistic person. He told me on the day that she got to the camps, she was selected to live. And there were lines that were formed all over that part of the camp for people waiting to have the tattoos put on them, which we all know about. She, totally believing that she was going to survive this, says to herself, she was only, I think, 15 at the time, she says, you know something? I'm going to have this tattoo for the rest of my life. I want to have a really good-looking tattoo. So she looks for the longest line, because she figures the longest line must be the most meticulous and careful tattoo artist. And she joins the longest line. And in fact, he told me she has a very good-looking tattoo on her arm. Now, who would think of that? Here you're in the shadow of death in one of the most awful places in the world ever devised by man. And she's looking for the long line. Amazing, amazing. The other story I wanted to tell you about optimism, which is one of my favorite stories about optimism, was a story told to me by the chief rabbi of England, by Rabbi Dr. Sacks, Sir Sacks. I was asked to be scholar in residence for a couple of days at his, he has a conference every few years, a retreat for the rabbis of the UK. And he stood in front and took notes and then would give me a reading list and input on every one of my lectures, which was terrific. And after I spoke, I think, on this topic, he told me the following vignette, which is an amazing vignette. He said, somebody was running for office in London. No, might not have been in London. It might have been just in the UK. He wouldn't tell me who. He said somebody famous. And he said the person had been ahead in the polls, but now was behind in the polls. And the person was running an incredibly negative campaign centered around anti-Jewish, anti-Israel sentiment. So he called this politician up and asked if he could meet with him. And the politician said, Rabbi, you know, with all due respect, no. You're not going to change my mind on Israel. You're not going to change my mind about the Arab-Israel conflict. I don't want to waste my time. I'm a busy man. Now, Rabbi Sacks is a very valued political consultant. He's close to the Queen, close to the Prime Minister. He said, I'll cut you a deal. I'm going to give you free political advice. If the word Jew or Israel crosses my lips, you can kick me out. But I'm just going to give you a piece of advice and I'm going to leave. He goes to the politician's office and he just tells him one study, a study done by Dr. Seligman, the founder of positive psychology. Seligman took a group of his graduate students and he gave them, without identification, the victory speech of every Republican victor at the presidential nomination, and every Democratic victor. He stripped it of identifiers, and he told his students, score each speech not for content, just for optimism versus pessimism. Every positive optimistic statement, give it a plus. Every negative pessimistic statement, give it a minus. It turns out the optimism score predicted who would become president of the United States at a higher level of accuracy than any poll did. Interesting. The power of optimism, both as a connector to religion, as a connector maybe even to survival, and as a connector even to political success. The man, by the way, won the election, he told me. Whether that was good or bad, I don't know. But that's what happened. The...
You think there's kind of like a... there's probably some point where it curves down. People can say, like, this person is in La La Land, and they're really, they're in a different reality than not in this world. So.
If you're Pollyannish, yeah, I'm sure that's true. That's an important point. Optimism and authors on optimism, we're going to have a class that'll get into this maybe a little bit next week, is optimism always has to be grounded in reality. Like, you can't try to teach a kid to be optimistic by making him or her believe that they're better than anybody else when in fact it's not backed up with facts. Optimism is most successful when it's grounded in a person's real opportunities and real abilities and real skills. So that's an important point. And the research clearly shows that. General research on optimism shows that optimists are more likely to persevere in the face of difficulty. Good reason why educators need to get tuned into this whole topic of positive psychology. They're more likely to cope effectively with stress. They have lower rates of postpartum depression. They handle life transitions better and even are more popular, more likely to win elections, like the story I just told you. Now I'm going to get into, for the remaining time, in a fairly rapid way, a number of practical recommendations. They could be used with kids and adolescents, but try to think about using them in your own life. Totally tied to what we've been talking about until now. So I'm going to just go through, no questions or interruptions, and we'll have discussion afterwards. So let me start with the best possible self and goal setting, and let's get going with this. There's a interesting technique that's been found to be associated with increased happiness called the best possible self technique. And now all of these strategies come from a wonderful book by a well-known expert on happiness, a psychologist, I believe at Stanford, whose name is Dr. Lyubomirsky. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, in a book called The How of Happiness, a very well-done book for the general public that's grounded in very good, trusted, and respected empirical research. On the best possible self set of studies that was done by Dr. King, what's described is that when people spend 20 minutes on four consecutive days writing a description of their best possible future selves, it leads to higher levels of happiness. So what they're asked to visualize, let's say down the road, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, visualize the best possible future for yourself in multiple domains of life. Try to imagine what your life would be like if all of your dreams were realized. In essence, getting in touch with the reality of realizing your most cherished long-term goals, what happens is, for a several-month period, they report higher levels of happiness and improved feelings of physical well-being over a several-month period. The actual directions given by the researchers in a writing section was they were asked to write down as often and as long as they wished over 4 weeks the following message. Here's exactly what they're told, verbatim. You imagine yourself in the future after everything has gone as well as it possibly could. You have worked hard and succeeded at accomplishing all your life goals. Think of this as the realization of your life dreams and of your own best potentials. This worked best in those who found interesting and challenging ways of thinking about us and practiced it with effort. But as we think about the whole idea of the connection between goals and meaning, this begins to make sense. Let's look at it from even a Jewish standpoint, through the prism of Jewish thought. In Mishle, it says, in Proverbs, it says, Be'en chazon yifora am, roughly translated means, without that vision thing, you disintegrate. We need to have vision. We need to have goals. It turns out that putting goals in writing can help you recognize that it's in your power to work towards a valued goal. It actually promoted an approach based on internal action rather than belief that luck or external forces would lead to realization of dreams. Now, very interesting insight that I heard from Rav Gedalia Shor in Or Gedalyahu. He had an incredible insight. Let me just share it with you on this, and then we'll talk about the Pizesna Rebbe for a second. Rav Gedalia Shor said, he talks about the well-known Rashi at the beginning of Vayichi. So we have Vayigash goes into Vayichi in that Torah reading, and we have normally between the various sections there's an open space. There's none. So Rashi asks Lama Parsha Zu Stuma, and we're told because it's almost like a visual metaphor for the psychological experience of slavery. The beginning of Vayichi marks the beginning of our subjugation as slaves in Egypt. The essence of slavery is that you have no mastery over your own time. So we're told that the essence of slavery is that there's no pause to breathe. There's no pause to be able to reflect. There's no pause to be able to step back and look at your goals. Rabbi Shor then contrasts this to Shira, to the Song of Redemption, to Az Yashir. Anybody who ever saw a Torah and what a Torah looks like around the Shira, wide open spaces. And Rabbi Shor says that what you see here is a very powerful lesson, that the essence of slavery, the essence of being a free man, of being a free woman, is having the time and the psychological space to reflect, to take a step back and to think, what are your dreams? In the research on marriage, they show that couples and families that take the time to reconnect and share each other's dreams. That's why vacations are so important. That's why going out on a regular basis, even after you have children and are incredibly busy, is so important. Because it turns out, the research shows, is being able to reconnect to each other's dreams, fantasies, and goals is a major predictor of how well you're going to do in facing the stresses in life. So the benefits of goal setting are threefold. The benefits of goal setting are, A, it gives you a sense of purpose. It gives you structure and control versus apathy and indifference. You ever see an apathetic, cynical person who has no passion in their life? They tend to be very depressed people. They're not fun to be around, and they tend to lack that joy of living. In contrast to the passion we were talking about before, when you have a goal, it leads to confidence. Think of the people you know who have goals in life. People, you're going for your master's, you're going for your doctorate, you're going for whatever it is in life. You may be learning the Daf Yomi, or you may have a hobby that you're engrossed in, or some kind of cause, or it could be the goal of just being connected to your family and making that an all-important thing on your mattering map. Dr. Lyubomirsky says, find a happy person and you'll find a project. Very interesting kind of insight. Now, this is important stuff, and I'd like to get through this and then we'll have discussion, is what are the characteristics of goals most likely to be related to happiness? And it's basically has these three components. One, is intrinsic versus extrinsic, meaning that it's not about reward and punishment. You're working on a goal, not because you're afraid that you're going to get a C on the class, or that you're afraid that you won't be able to keep your scholarship in Canada up, or you're afraid that somehow that you're going to be punished if you're a student for not doing this or not doing that. Intrinsic. It's something, as we're told by the Gemara, Mashalibo chafetz, mishalibo chafetz, something you're passionate about that comes from deep inside your soul. That's an intrinsic kind of goal. You don't even have to be taught it if you're a baby. My year and a half old granddaughter, who's into walking and the mastery of walking, she's drunk with walking. That's her goal now. That's what she does for a living, right? You all know that great, you know, they get up and they rush and they fall down. And whatever it is they're up to, an adolescent who's drunk with having reached formal apparitions so they could think about thought and can think in an abstract way, what's that about? That adolescent is drunk with it. They don't have to be told to do it. They love questioning. And that's where their sarcasm and their wordplay and their love of bad poetry or humor that's not very tasteful may come from. It's the abstract thinking that they've finally gotten to, and it doesn't have to be pushed on them. When a goal is intrinsic, we just do it, and you do it with joy and with love and with happiness. Authentic. A goal can't come from your parents' fantasies about who you want they want you to be. They can't come from your community's fantasies. It can't be that you become a doctor because your parents dreamed of your being a doctor, or you become wealthy because your parents want you to reach certain yardsticks of success that they may have never reached. It has to come, your goal, from the still small voice inside of you that is not coming from the expectations of family or society. And then finally, goals that are not viewed as a threat but are viewed as a challenge, that are a part of an approach. You're doing it out of the love of doing it rather than out of the avoidance of something you're afraid of. So those are the three characteristics of goals that make the most sense. So that's part one. Part two, in terms of some approaches to happiness, is overthinking. It turns out the people who think too much tend to get themselves in trouble, and overthinking is associated with getting sucked into the quicksand of depression versus not. Here's some examples of overthinking. Here's a cartoon. A man is bringing back a small car that he just bought with an advertisement for this car gets 42 miles per gallon, and he complains it only gets 41 miles to the gallon. That's overthinking, okay? We know that people who constantly daven over the meanings and causes of their problems, those who ruminate when they're sad, tend to get even more pulled into their sadness. They overthink. Overthinking is not a good thing. Happy individuals, when they look at whether something is in their control or not in their control, if it's in their control, they work to solve it. If it's not in their control, they distract themselves. Now, how do they distract themselves when the problems they face are not in their control to solve? We know that there are a number of characteristics of healthy distraction. Number one is the pullback strategy, the ability to pull back, not get sucked in it, and depending on your personality and your interests, you might be better at distracting yourself by talking to somebody and talking it out. It may be through getting pulled into music or some physical activity if you're into sports. It might be exercise. It might be reading. It might be something along those lines. So distraction is a good way of getting away of the pullback response from overthinking. Daily worry time is another popular technique that the literature talks about, where you basically say, look, instead of me thinking nonstop about this to the point of nausea, I'm going to schedule 30 minutes at the end of the day to just sit down and think out or talk out or write out exactly what I'm worried about. It's rare you could do it for more than 30 minutes. But that way, during the other 23 hours and 40 minutes of the and 30 minutes of the day, you say, look, if you're overthinking, I'll think about it during my daily worry time. And then writing things out, or a stop technique is a pullback technique where you either have a rubber band around your hand and you stretch it out and have it snap at you before you get into the over-ruminating, or you put a stop sign up in your head. Sometimes that helps if you do it early on. Now, what else did I want to talk about in terms of pullback responses to combat overthinking? Any small step you take to deal with the thing that you're worried about and that's pulling you into depression can make a difference, even small baby steps. Also, getting a more active approach by tuning into triggers and taking action to avoid them when possible. So you find out, what am I most likely to overthink? And then you get into that. And then perspective. Perspective is often very helpful, especially for people who are good at cognitive problem solving, being able to ask yourself, what was I worried about last year at this time? Almost always, if you think back, when you were here last summer, what was your number one problem? Was it a big deal? Was it worth losing sleep over? No.
Same as now, doing your assignments.
Exactly. Exactly. Will this be a problem in a year?
Yep.
Ask yourself that question. Good point. So going from threat to challenge, appreciating the growth-inducing properties of problems is what makes the most sense. Now, one more thing is the research on social comparison. We talked about how damaging it is to one's sense of well-being and happiness if you're always measuring yourself against somebody who has more. Happy individuals, in very interesting research, they give puzzles to somebody. And next to them is a confederate who really knows how to do the puzzles. With people who are prone to depression, if the person next to them does really well on the puzzle, they don't know it, they've been fed the answers, it'll make them feel depressed and they won't persevere as much in doing the puzzle. They're always comparing themselves to the next person. They savor the failures of others and actually are destroyed by the successes of others. Happy people, if they see good things happening to other people, they're actually happy for them. And they feel bad for people when bad things happen, but they measure themselves based on their own internal set of standards. So that's another piece of this in terms of social comparison. What people need to learn to do is how to somehow pull back from doing that and how to change their compass so that it's more of an internal than an external kind of compass. One last thing, and then we'll go to discussion and end this, and that's there's a whole new literature, actually a new book just came out on this, on empirical literature in the positive psychology field on savoring. Savoring means the ability to really enjoy. Imagine if you weren't rushing through your morning shower. You could just like take an extra 5 minutes to just enjoy it and turn your head off. Imagine if in your walk on the beautiful Washington Heights campus, you were able to stop and smell the rose, okay? Imagine if you were able to do that. The ability to build savoring into your life is something that actually can be associated with happiness. So savoring in the dictionary is defined as any thought or behavior capable of generating, intensifying, and prolonging in enjoyment. All too often in life, we have a natural tendency to postpone our happiness and believe that tomorrow will bring the ultimate happiness. We're always saying, well, we'll get there after we finish school, after we make some X amount of money, after we retire. And the reality is, as this really nice quote says, enjoy the little things, for one day you may look back and realize they were the big things. Very nice way of putting it. Savoring comes naturally when an illness disappears. I was just thinking, I was traveling somewhere and my suitcase was lost. And it came back a day later. So I went for a day without any of my basic necessities. When the suitcase came back 24 hours later, the most basic things I enjoyed. The most basic things that I hadn't. Now, how long did that last? Probably for about 2 hours. The question is, can you build that kind of savoring into your life in a more regular kind of way? So it's easy to do when you have a toothache and the toothache goes away, or an illness disappears, or something we lost reappears. You ever have that feeling? You lost something and then you get it back and you really enjoy it much more. I'm looking for my trio here. So that kind of thing. So what are some savoring strategy? It's to take a few minutes once a day to relish something that you usually hurry through, a walk, a meal, a shower. Focus on how the event is experienced differently than when it's rushed through. Savoring with the camera is the strategy that Lia Bomorsky talks about. She says, very often we miss the most important events of our lives. You may be at a child's bris, or you may be on a vacation, and all the photographer is doing is photographing away. Instead, try to capture the essence of what it is that you love about the event, and just take one or two pictures of it and capture it that way. That picture will mean a lot more to you, and it's a way of developing this muscle of savoring. Now, positive reminiscing is a nice technique, is make a list of happy memories, personal mementos like pictures or souvenirs. In one study, they did the following script. They did this twice daily for a week, and it led to increased levels of happiness for a number of months. So first they had the people who were part of the experiment just make a list of, let's say, their 10 top Hall of Fame positive memories. Then it said, first turn to your list of positive memories, choose one to reflect upon. Then sit down, take a deep breath, relax, close your eyes, and begin to think about the memory. Allow images related to the memory to come to mind. Try to picture the events associated with this memory in your mind. Use your mind to imagine the memory. Let your mind wander freely through the details of the memory while you're imagining the memory. That is, again, the essence of what we're talking about. So to summarize some of these techniques, what do they have all in common? What they all have in common is connecting us to what matters in life. So you're connecting yourself to your goals. You're taking that pause, the essence of that space in the Shira. It's the essence of our ability to connect to what matters, to savor what matters, to be able to also not get caught up in the quicksand of ruminating and focusing on the slights in life. And you take some of those together and you have some of the basic building blocks of happiness. Now, this is far from exhaustive. We're going to talk about other strategies. We'll talk about strategies with children next week. But let's get to discussion now in our remaining 10 minutes or so. Yeah?
I'm not so familiar with the psychological world that can you give me an insight? Let's say you come in, somebody comes in really depressed adolescent. Will you get them to want to talk to you more, or will you get them to want to buy into some of these ideas how to become happier? Like, which way would it be?
Yeah, now this isn't meant to be telling you how to do psychotherapy with a depressed adolescent.
Right.
Although we're going to do that a little bit on Tuesday. We're going to go through Seligman's optimism training program for kids, where he teaches parents and then teaches the parents how to teach their kids how to be optimistic. And that's a little bit more like what therapy is like. With adolescents, you do it a little bit differently, but in essence, you would do the same thing. You would get them to get involved in activities. You'd get them to find one of the popular techniques in therapy for depressed adolescents is you find, you have them engaged in two activities a day. One that gives them mastery, one that gives them pleasure. It turns out that if you could get them working with you on it, it's as predictive of the depression lifting as whether they take their medication or not. Just that one thing called activity planning. Then you do a lot of other things that may or may not include some of these issues. You probably wouldn't be doing, until they get out of the depression, you'd probably be working much more on having them learn how to catch their thoughts and having them learn how to think in a more accurate way about life. But in essence, this is more general strategies in your own life that you could then build in as an educators into, for example, as background music in people's lives. If you could get them to take a step back and think more optimistically, you get them to take a step back and think about goals. I didn't talk about the Pia Zestner. The Pia Zestner, as you know, who was a brilliant educator in Chovas HaTalmidim, in a student's obligation, he would have his students get a 6-month plan. He'd say, where do you want to see yourself in 6 months? And again, that's the Be'en Chazon Yifara'am kind of thing. And he somehow communicated to his students that global picture. Now, kids, for the most part, young kids can't do that. Adolescents might be able to do that. There might be a lot of benefit, just in general, to taking adolescents, to getting them past thinking about what college or what yeshiva they want to go to as the next step. And you get them thinking about the bigger picture. What's important to you in life? You get them hooked into meaning. That's tied as a byproduct of that into happiness. You were going to say something, yeah.
Can eighth grader think about, I mean, they can obviously contemplate a little bit about life skills, but to take an exercise like that very seriously?
Yeah, this whole section was more for you. It was more for you. I don't know that you could do this with an 8th grader. You might be able to do it with an 11th and a 12th grader. This is more for you in terms of just thinking about these more global pictures. But I don't think you could do goal planning with a kid that age that easily. But you could do it very effectively, I think, with a somewhat older kid. Because they're very into it. Is that you get into later adolescence, they're very into meaning-making, thinking about the future, thinking about... I'll give you an example of some of the questions. We're going to talk about this on Tuesday. Some of the questions that you could ask an adolescent in high school is, what is the bumper sticker of your family? What does it take to be a hero in your family? What do you want to have for a bumper sticker in your family when you grow up and get older? How do you want to be different? How do you want your life to be the same? You get them to think about these things, and it actually has... some of the benefits that we're talking about here that you see in adults as well. To do that with an 8th grader, they may be just a little bit too far from formal operations to really be able to get it. But you could fool around with it and see where it goes. Their head is not going to be into that until a little bit later, though.
The other aspects of the previous presentation, even today's, but the earlier one, on happiness, I think, could be very effective.
Like, how would you build it in?
I wouldn't build it into a class. I'd make it into a class. Like, I have a class that I eat once a week. It's basically, it's once a week I do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
With the eighth grader, I can teach them anything that any particular thing that I want. So I've decided what I want to do. So I think that if you,
they love it. The happiness workshops, they love it. I've done this with kids, especially with high school kids. When you get them to think about these basic kind of issues like happiness or like where do they want to go in life, what do they think money will bring them, what do they think a more rewarding kind of job than, let's say, one that they're not particularly interested in may bring them, it's actually where they live. Adolescents live there. You know, they like that stuff. Yeah. Maybe. The only way to know is to try it. It depends on a lot of factors. It may very well be something that you could do it for.
I was speaking to a rabbi, and he was telling me that the way that, especially people who are learning in Kol, a lot of times people get burnt out or they just don't see themselves going places. So such an important thing is to make themselves a goal. Because he was driving down Yerushalayim with his son, and they parked their car. He saw somebody walking down, standing up straight. Looked very accomplished. You know, the person was he told us, he said, "See that guy over there? He's for sure writing a cipher." So the kid has to be like, you know, he's got to be person. He jumps out of the car and asks the guy, "Are you writing a cipher?" He said, "Yeah, how'd you know?"
Very good. By the way, it's a real issue. It's a real issue that I see some of my friends who work a lot with yeshiva guys who were long-term in Kolo, is a problem that takes place sometimes psychologically. I have friends who are therapists who we will sometimes talk about this as being a real issue. It's not talked about very much, but high levels of depression. This friend's a psychiatrist who has a high percentage of certain colas on antidepressants, because what happens is that after a while you lose focus, you're not graded, you're not necessarily accountable, because it's all intrinsic motivation. But after a while, it could become a little difficult to maintain that focus, like you're saying. And they need, now I doubt that would happen if the Kol guy is teaching in the community, or is somehow doing chesed, or is involved in something out of just the pure learning. But pure learning without a product or without a connection to something else, just impressionistically, I'm sure it's definitely for certain people, but I could tell you about one well-known kollel where my psychiatrist friends who consults to them says that a very high percentage, she has a very high percentage of the kollel on antidepressants. Now, I'm not saying, it's just a fact. And this happens to be a kollel where guys stay, it's a kollel that has people for a very, very long time. So, and it's not easy. I'm not knocking it, I'm not praising it. I'm just saying you have to look at that, and then the answer is, should they be doing something to bring them into the next step? Should they be more connected to the community? Should they be more connected to teaching or to somehow getting a project like writing a sefer or giving a shiur, whatever it might be, because otherwise it becomes very hard, except for an elite few, to maintain it in that kind of nonstop way. And this particular cult is known for it because they keep guys learning without giving back to the community for an inordinately long period of time. So that's something to think about. I don't know. This particular, my friend specializes in this particular kolo. So he tells me, and they call him. The Rosh Yeshiva calls them all the time. I get called from, I sometimes get these people in my office, and it's sometimes I need to push them into that next step. I don't mean in terms of leaving kolo, but in terms of getting past that intensity, which is not good for everybody. It's good for some people, but not for everybody. Anyway, yeah.
Would it be helpful to try to tell them that everything that they're doing is eventually going to be utilized in helping the community?
Well, they know.
So they're going to look at, like right now they're not helping the community. They look at it like,
well, they know that. That's why they're doing it, in essence. They know it, but it's...
A lot of people, I mean, like when I was in Kelly, your goal was not to eventually become a one to cure the Rebbe. Your goal was just to learn. Most of the Kelly's that I know of, that guys, that's all they do. That's all they're supposed to do.
So then the question...
There's no smicha, there's nothing. You learn the Masechta. You have a 7-year cycle of Masechta, and you just go through them. There's nothing else. No focus on a lot, no focus on anything, just learning.
Yeah. And there, the question is, does it have the characteristics of goals that are tied to happiness? Is it intrinsic? Okay, which it may very well be. Is it really coming from you? Is it consonant with what you want and who you are and what your abilities are and what your dreams are? And then is it something that you really enjoy? You have to really enjoy it also. You know, so it has to be a component of it that speaks to you. I think that if any of those ingredients are missing, it might at times become problematic. And it may work for a while, but then at a certain point, it may just become hard to keep it up. Especially as there's increasing financial pressures and increasing family pressures, and so it's not so simple. The reality is as you know, I don't know how many years you learned in kollel for, but it's okay. So, did it get harder as time went on, psychologically?
I kind of have to get out overall, but I'm saying it wasn't, it didn't get harder, but I felt I learned this very early. First of all, I learned Chazara really gives you a lot of sequel. I never wanted to accomplish a lot. You review. It's like aim simple, like I was saying, you know exactly what you know, and you're clear about it, and you build on that. That's amazing. And also, I looked at every minute I was in Kailo that I was going to be investing in cholesterol. There's never a secret. There's never like as if like I'm doing, somebody else out there is doing cute, but I'm not. Because right now, I'm developing myself much better, and I think you become much, much more effective. Every minute you learn, every minute you stay learning, and you...
Yeah, I hear you. And that's an important point. So that's a great attitude to have. But also, what you said about mastery is important. What sometimes becomes debilitating is if you don't have that mastery or you don't show it to yourself, so that it's all process, no product in your head. If in your head you're saying, look, I really know Kedushin. I really know it, and I really understand it at a level that I think I could really give a good psak when it comes to a question if I'm a Seder Kedushin sometimes or if I have to deal with an issue related to people having, whatever, you know, in a practical way that resonates or gives you insight into marital problems or whatever it is. I know that's not a good example, but that I think probably helps also. So, you know, to make it relevant in some way. But for some people, it's that, like you say, temperament is a lot of it also. Having a naturally optimistic temperament is a big part of that. Okay, so we'll pick up on one more thing on happiness itself on Tuesday, God willing. And be well. Mincha, yeah.
Beth Kantz wants me to tell you that she needs to book your flight for Champions Games. And this is her prayer. Give her a call, please.
I will.
Start booking it today or something. I don't know. Just a message.
I'll take care of it. No, that's. Thanks. Thanks.
How are you?
Good.
Hello.
Message from Stekla. Are you expecting him in the class? He said he's probably not going to be continuing in the class.
Something I said or something I thought?
Too much work? Yeah, I don't know. That's what he said. He has some messages.
Tell him thanks for telling me. Thank you.
Also, just interesting, the last thing about Cole, I found also, I got married, you know, just 4 months ago. I'm 27, I find a lot with older guys. Well, let's say I've been dating for a while, and they're like, heading up in the yeshiva, you know, or like the older guys in the yeshiva, a lot of times a similar thing happens. They burn out, they fizzle out, because they feel like they're just kind of like static, they're not moving. You know, everybody else is getting married, or even more, going into Cole.
Makes sense, and these guys are like,